boy, oh boy, some of you are saying. We get to go down to Las Vegas and talk to Uncle Johnny. Oh my, are we going to hear some stories tonight. Hello, John Barber. How's my friend tonight?
Well, how sweet of you. Know, I have very ambivalent feelings about being called Uncle Johnny.
I know, I shouldn't have said that. I know why. I caught myself too late.
That's all right, because all these, after my father left home and my mother became an alcoholic and picked up all these uncles came around like grapes. There were just bunches of them, you know.
Oh, take a number, uncles.
There's a very, very, very lovely lady I'm going to mention to you very, very briefly. And her I've never met her, but we're the closest of friends on Facebook. And she is a gorgeous, very funny little girl. Her name is Victoria, and the nickname is Tori, and she calls me Uncle Johnny. So I really like that. And also, you know, it seems like you must be some kind of reserve good luck charm who pops up every time I'm about to do your show. About 3.5 months ago, my general practitioner, whom I have to go in and see every 3 or 4 or 5 months, checked me out. He put a stethoscope on my chest.
Right.
And he said, "You're feeling pain?" And I said, "No." I said, "Just a little ticklish." And he said, "Well, there's something wrong there." And I said, "Well, there's nothing wrong with me, I'm sure." I'm going to give you a cardiogram. So he gives me this cardiogram, and he looks at it, and he said, "I'm going to have to fix you up with a cardiologist." I said, "Hold it. I was here 3 months ago. You did the same thing, and I was fine. I'm feeling better now than 3 months ago. So what's going on?" He says, "I don't know, so I'm going to send you to a cardiologist." So he sends me to this lovely young Mexican, well, she's almost a girl. She was an immigrant, came from a homeless family in Mexico, and joined the American military so she could go to college to become a cardiologist. And wow, she was fabulous. And her name was Blanca. And so I walked in there, and one of the reasons I loved her so much at first meeting, I wear these gorgeous, I have two really expensive, gorgeous silver bracelets on both my right wrist and my left wrist. I mean, they're very expensive, and they were gifts. And she looked at them, and she said, "Holy shit, you got more jewels than I have. I love women with a potty mouth." So anyway, she looked at the cardiogram, and as she was doing that, and we started to chat, we got along great. My God, did we ever. And so I asked her why she became a cardiologist instead of a surgeon. And she says, "I can't stand the sight of blood, but there are some people I would love to cut open." Oh, my God, you got to love somebody like that.
Oh, that's funny.
So good, people came to her to go into private practice. So she did, and sadly left, sent me a sweet goodbye note, and put me in touch with a wonderful, wonderful aging cardiologist who's 10 years younger than I am. So I go in to see him, and he puts a stethoscope there.
Well, wait a minute. Hold on.
What?
Your first guy didn't tell you what the hell he was referring you for. She didn't tell you what was going on with you. Now you're at the third guy. All sitting on the edge of our seats.
Okay, well, she looked at my general practitioner's cardiogram, and she said, "This is a shitty cardiogram." That's all she said. Now, when she's leaving, she gives me the new guy she's sending me to and says, "You'll love him," because she's going into private practice. Right. So I see him, and he puts a stethoscope there, and he said, "Gosh, you sound fine to me." And so he said, "I'm going to send you across the street to the best woman in town who serves the very best cardiologists in town, and she's going to take absolute perfect pictures of your heart. And it's more than a stethoscope. So I went to see her. She wore no mask. And she said, "You can I wear a Superman mask along with a Superman shirt." She said, "Take your shirt off and take your mask off. You don't have to do that here." She was adorable, too. And she did all of these tests. Now, yesterday, I go back to Mike Seagram is his name, my cardiologist. And this lady just raves about him, says, you know, he's the best in town. Even on weekends, he will go and see his patients. He's just wonderful. So he says, he looks at her report and he says, "You know what? You shouldn't even be here." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, her report is just, you're in perfect health." He said, "Okay, but first, let me verify that." So he puts his stethoscope up there on my heart. And then with his hands, he feels my ankles. And I said, "What are you doing down there?" He said, "I want to make sure your blood is flowing properly. I've never had anybody that smart." And I said, "I'm really in good shape." He said, "Your heart is pumping better than an Arabian oil well. So you can go out and start playing golf again." Oh, and then speaking of that.
That's really good news. That's wonderful news.
It was just wet yesterday. But I just want to tell you, because your Gmail is an indication, the address of your Gmail is an indication that you are interested in this subject I'm about to measure, as is George Knapp, who's a real junkie about it. He is my second or third best friend in Las Vegas. Is that yesterday, aside from the good news, we spotted a UFO over Las Vegas.
Ah. Daytime, nighttime?
It was the sun.
Oh, God. You set me up for that one. All right.
We haven't seen it for 3 months. I have been here for 25 years, and I have never seen weather as bad as this. And so I don't get out. Every day I play 9 holes of golf, because if I'm not physically or mentally active, Jeff, I am just absolutely, totally worthless. Now, and half of my friends, I have to tell you about one of them who has been catheterizing because of bad bladder for 3 years when we finally get on the golf course. But after last week's show, a number of people contacted
last month's show.
Well, see how time flies.
You got it. Sure does.
Last month's show, I had a number of people contacting me, wanting to know how I stay in good mental and good physical health. And you well know, and even my son knows, and even my wife knows, I give no advice to absolutely anyone. Never have and never will, you know. So, but what I did in this case, I sent them all. Sometimes when I get angry, upset, and I got nothing to do, I don't like to write prose because it's just not interesting to me. So I write these dopey little quatrains or these couplets. So I sent them this. The three things to avoid to make you feel good. The short list is easy, and each and every one could. Two of the worst are refined sugar and booze. But the deadliest of all is this. Avoid the goddamn news. anyway.
Ain't that the truth? Oh, jeez.
Yeah. I got to tell you, I'm going to be really tied up a lot in about a month, so I'm not sure if I can. I love doing your show, but my webmaster, Stu Shostak, it's going to be my 90th birthday, and he's preparing two-hour shows and picking, going through hundreds of hours of what he calls the best material in television to try to pick out 4 hours, two different hours, and to do two shows. So he wants me to help him concentrate on that. So,
well, fortunately, we hope you'll be done by the time next month's program runs around on the 28th, because your birthday, everyone out there, if you want to send, get ready, John Barber's birthday, number 90.
Yeah.
24th of April.
Yeah, but you
so
know
maybe
what,
you'll be done with all that. Whatever.
Well, whatever. And what I tell them to avoid the news, I also add this observation, Jeff, that in almost every aspect of American life, I've seen an increasing, depressing decline in values, excellence, and commitment, so much so it has also crept in to the commitment between men and women, especially in marriage. For centuries, pardon me for amusing myself, but for centuries, up until the 60s and the 70s, mm-hmm. after signing the marriage certificate, each vowed in sickness and in health until death do us part. But beginning in the 80s, even before signing the marriage certificate, they now signed a prenuptial agreement.
Yes, they do. Yeah.
Then society deteriorated so quickly, suddenly in the 90s. Now the first thing they sign is a non-disclosure agreement.
Oh, too funny. So this is actually, an NDA is actually being signed by some people in addition to a prenup?
Yes.
This is hilarious.
Oh, my God, yes. Well, you
Who'd have thought Trump, that possible?
I know, but Trump has a few of those, and I know a few people have a few of those. And, you know, it's weird. I have I've had this weird map that I've designed, and USA stands for unsafe anywhere. And the United States is now defined as a country where it is no longer illegal to rob a bank, especially if you're a CEO.
John, you haven't lost one eighth of a step. It's right on top of your game.
Well, you know, it's because it was so dark. I'm in here locked up entertaining myself. But I do have to, I made a couple of notes about it because I love talking to you, love doing your show. It's so free and easy. But I've made a couple of notes, and let's see if I can read some of my own notes. When an ex-president is responsible for destroying a bank, mm-hmm. he is much, much worse than a bank robber who, when caught, goes to prison. He is doing and destroying two things, this ex-president: his duty to the law and to the public. There are two ex-presidents still running around who have done just that, unfortunately, whom I'll get to in a minute. Since there is no Hans Brinker to stick his finger into the dike of the degeneration of American politics and the Constitution and the Bill of Rights since the murder of John Kennedy, I have hated to talk about anything political. It is just too dark and too hopeless. But, Jeff, in light of the fact that millions of Americans may now lose their savings with more financial disasters to come, I am forced to point out these obvious, terrible truths. And I say truths because they are. They are not opinion, which I avoid assiduously. They are not truths that I've read or heard about either. They are truths through which I have lived during my 80-some-odd bumpy years. But first, for those who don't know me, a few simple words about my meager political beliefs, the remnants of them. I am a radical Jeffersonian constitutionalist who believes, as he did, that there should be a revolution in this country every 20 years to restore the tree of liberty and democracy. And the rise of corporations and banks should be curtailed, he said, so they do not become the dominant force in our democratic society. Imagine, Jeff, he said that hundreds of years ago. That's we amazing. Have failed in the latter and are 10 revolutions behind. In the 1930s, capitalism and future bank depositors were saved by an act introduced by Franklin Roosevelt and his socialist vice president, Henry Wallace. It was called Glass-Steagall. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Yeah. This law would prevent all banks from, saying it simply, taking unprotected risks with depositors' money. This act protected us until 1999, when America's worst president, but most charming lecher, Bill Clinton, repealed it, saying publicly, quote, it was no longer appropriate, unquote. This inevitably led immediately to a growing greed of Wall Street and the banks in the 2008 depression, in which myself and hundreds of thousands lost their homes and most of their savings. And horribly, not one homeowner or depositor was helped, but every bank and investment firm was bailed out with our tax money, Jeff. Remember this? Because they were identified as, quote, too big to fail.
Too big. Yep, too big.
That's it. And no one went to prison. And then in 2018, Donald Trump, a totally unqualified president, but richer lech, deregulated the entire banking system at the urging of the CEO of the Silicon Valley Bank, saying, now they have the freedoms to grow, unquote. And indeed, it was only the CEOs who did grow. They grew richer.
Ain't that the truth? Yeah.
I am beyond the stage, Jeff, of ever hoping that half of our presidents and half of our politicians be sent to prison for breaking and avoiding the laws. We have seen in America that does not happen to the richest. Like the game Monopoly, they all get out of stay out of jail free card.
Yeah.
I am now comfortably at that don't give a shit daydreaming stage where I hope we could just simply bypass the courts and just send them to prison for incompetence. And I hope you guys all have a great day, because there's so few of them left. Now, I've got to get to this since I mentioned Trump.
You mentioned the most, what did you call him? Charming lecher Clinton?
Yeah, Bill Clinton.
Who was the most repulsive lecher in relatively recent presidential history? The most despicable, the most vile, the most ugly.
Well, I would have to say it would have to be Donald Trump.
No. Before that. No, this guy's worse. This guy's worse.
Well, you know.
I'll give you the initials. LBJ.
Oh, my God, yes. And, you know, Joan Mellon wrote the very best book about LBJ, and it's called A Faustian Bargain. It is brilliant. Now, it's interesting you mention him, because your Johnny's going to mention him here, because I made this note after all the hazardry about them going to arrest Donald Trump last Tuesday. It's Friday already. Okay, so here's what it is that I made a note of. To have politicians and pontificators in the media talking about being no one being above the law is an absolute fucking joke. Sorry, I hate to say joke. It should be spelled flaw, F-L-A-W. As every one of my friends knows, and all my golfing buddies know, I am no Donald Trump fan, even though each one of them voted for him. But I am much less a fan of the flaw. When on earth did any district attorney's office or any FBI office ever pre-announce the arrest of someone? They just showed up and kicked in the goddamn door, and many times it was the wrong door. So why this ridiculous, laughable pre-announcement?
It's showbiz. It's all it's horse manure, showbiz.
Yeah, of the possible arrest of Donald Trump, who certainly is a liar and a crook and a pussy-grabbing philanderer and adulterer. But he definitely is not a war criminal. So if there's such bullshit as no one above the flaw, why aren't these DAs and FBI agents kicking down the doors and arresting real war criminals and real criminals and confiscating their ill-gained assets like the Bushes for Iraq, Clinton for Waco, and LBJ's gang for Vietnam, and even Obama for a drone strike on a foreign wedding gathering, killing a 16-year-old teenager. In Poland, right now, comics are looking at us and telling American jokes. Comic to the audience.
That's funny. I'll bet they are. Oh, yeah.
Okay, comic to the audience. Did you guys hear about the American president who was indicted for war crimes? And they all holler no. And he says, neither did I.
Good one. Bravo. Yes. Can you imagine the rich and fertile grounds for comedy this country, this alleged government is providing to comics struggling everywhere? Jeez.
Yes, but I must tell you very honestly, and this may sound cruel, I love comics. Above all, I love comics. However, there is not one single comedian on the network or the internet today who has one line that's funny that you can quote.
It's all anger or profanity.
I wanted to mention this lady who is the mother of this little girl who calls me Uncle Johnny. Her name's Tori. I won't mention this lady's name. Jeff, I casually know a very attractive, very, very wealthy, middle-aged woman who could buy out Trump with her petty cash. Now, I don't want to tell you how much she owns, but when I say she's one of the richest women in the Northeast, she is, and she became a monster fan of mine because when she was 10 years of age, she fell in love with Jim Garrison and John Kennedy. And her parents even took her to Dallas to listen to all of the people talk and have dinner with Oliver Stone. So she has become, honestly, my closest Facebook friend. And she is driven nuts by what is going on in the world, but she is saved by a wit as sharp as Dorothy Parker's or Nora Ephron's. And she's made me laugh out loud a number of times, which I don't get to do too often.
No.
But the one I remember the most is this. She said to me one day, she said, "Johnny, having a lot of money doesn't make life easier, only shopping."
Cute. That's cute.
So, out of respect, to my dear friend's privacy. I will not mention her name so she will save from more overwhelming requests for money, which she gets from people who say to her, quote, I no longer want to find love anymore. Just a good place to shop will do.
Is she listening now?
Yeah, she's probably listening now.
Very good.
Getting okay, so, and a matter of fact, she was one of the, she asked me this, and I've been asked this a half a dozen times, and it's beyond me why they asked me this, because you see that I'm deep into Garrison, I'm deep into JFK, or maybe it's because of JFK, and both Garrison, who were A personalities, who had multiple women. So maybe that's the reason. Anyway, she and at least a half a dozen have asked me, pardon, I hate to say it, because of, I'm trying to say it in a nice way, Jim.
Because you're trying to stop from laughing out loud is what you're trying to do.
Yes, because of my interest in people, I often post about love, which it's true, friendship, and relationship.
Right.
Which is true. And because of this, I'm frequently asked, mostly only by women, this unexpected kind of shocking question. Johnny or John, do you prefer women with big breasts?
You get that question, do you?
Yes.
How interesting.
So
funny.
My response is always the same. Quote, no, I prefer a woman with a bigger brain. Quote. And then a number of them wrote back almost the same thing. Wow, Johnny, that is totally unlike most of the men I run into.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Why is that in your case? And I wrote back, because you cannot have a very long conversation with a breast. I have tried.
See, that's cute. And it's the truth of the matter is, men just have apparently they have an issue. And if there's a big boob there, all issues are solved.
That's right. Okay, but I have to
How about
you.
The young girls, John, who are 16 and they develop large chests? If they're smart, they know they'll never have to work a day in their lives.
Well, you know what Phyllis Diller said? She said, if they're big enough, they're old enough. That's a line from Phyllis Diller. But anyway, as I said earlier, I think all happiness is relative, I guess. The one day that the sun was out, I went playing with my buddies, the manager of one of the major hotels here in town, a really wonderful grandfather to his 12-year-old grandson, who comes from a very dysfunctional in-between family, terrible mother, terrible father, but the grandfather and he are inseparable, and they're great. Anyway, so he is... he's a golfing buddy, and because of bladder problems, has had to catheterize 3 or 4 times a day for 3 years. And today, that was the day we played on the golf course, he said it was one of the happiest days of his life. When I asked him why, he looked at me with the biggest grin and said, Johnny, I just pissed my pants.
Ironic humor. That's funny. That's
it's
good.
It's all real.
Good anyway, for him. Good job.
Yes. There has been a whole lot of stuff in the news about some kind of weird new drug that is not cocaine and it's not marijuana. It's somehow manufactured. And I take
Fentanyl.
Yeah, fentanyl. Okay, so. I put this up because this happened, let's see, 70, almost 70 years ago.
Okay.
Get a load of this. Almost 70 years ago. And I can remember it so well. And I called my sister and reread it to her, and she remembered it very well. Now I read it to you. It's a simple observation about drugs. 60 years ago, my sister Maggie was married to a smart Los Angeles sheriff's officer assigned to narcotics. Imagine even in those days, Jeff, they had somebody assigned to narcotics. One day, they chased a well-known dealer into his house in Watts. They searched for an hour and couldn't find out what they had photographed him carrying. And they searched every place and heard nothing, but they knew they couldn't leave, so they just kept hanging around until they heard a baby cry. They hunted for and found the baby's crib. They lifted the baby. There was no sheet, just a hole in the filthy mattress in which the baby shit. He put on a glove, stuck it in, and pulled out a huge pack of drugs. When he told me this, one of many horrible stories he told me, Jeff, I gasped. God, why would anybody take drugs? And he said calmly, Johnny, they could build a wall around this entire country 50 feet high and 50 feet thick, and in 50 years, it'll be 1,000 times worse. How prophetic was that? Wow. Now, America's not built to be building walls. But what my former brother-in-law predicted is now certainly true as to why people take drugs. John Lennon asked an even better question than I did. He said, quote, in order to find out why people take drugs, you had to find out what is wrong about life in America that makes people so unhappy.
Miserable. Yeah.
And psychologists and sociologists say it's poverty and broken homes that drive people to taking drugs. How wrong the experts are, again, because that would make me and my little sister the perfect candidates to taking them. Every drug addict I have known has been not just successful, but enormously successful. Then why is a kid with a runaway father, an absentee mother walking the streets alone from the time I was six, why did I not take them or even alcohol? The reason, simple. I had to survive life, not escape it. So I did not want anything at all that might alter
in the
my
way.
Brain. That include even cigarettes. And, of course, beer, which was the curse of my mother's failed life. So as simple as it sounds, the easiest way to avoid drugs is to find something in life that you absolutely love to do. I found two things. First, just the joy of being alive and discovering everything new that was around me. And then I discovered the work that I do and still love to do. And then my wife. So no matter what age you are, good luck in your search. Joseph Campbell said, follow your bliss and doors will open in the universe that you never knew existed that will lead you to your happiness. They opened for me. Good luck and good hunting. And that
very
is
good. Yeah, I've always urged people, find something in life that you love to do and do it to the best of your ability and you'll be successful. Success.
Persistence is everything. I think one of America's least admired presidents said that persistence is everything in life. And just a little sidebar story. When I was a kid, 14 to 16, before I ran away to this country, I wanted to be a professional gambler. And I was terrible at it until I got two books at the library opposite the jail called Scarnion Dice and Scarnion Card. But I played with guys who were ages 17 to 42. And there were seven of them, truck drivers in the military and just guys like me.
You played what, Johnny? What? You played with him?
Mostly it was poker.
Okay.
And right. or blackjack. And I was always the first to lose and the last to leave. And they all smoked and they all drank. Mm-hmm. And they were always offering me cigarettes, which I declined. And they always offered me beer, which I declined. And they asked me if I was some kind of religious fanatic. And I said, no. Yeah, if anything, I guess I'm a totally non-believer. And he says, well, how come you don't take a beer? You don't smoke? You go to the movies all the time and all those stars drink and they smoke, every one of them. And why not you? And I said, you want me to tell you the truth? And they said, yeah, sure. I said, well, I worked at a place called Byerly's. And one day, out of curiosity, because I loved Humphrey Bogart and the way he smoked, and Jimmy Cagney the way he smoked, so I stole a carton of cigarettes. I went into my backyard and I smoked one. The smoke got in my eyes, made my eyes water. I got sick to my stomach. And I didn't want to get caught with all of the evidence. So I smoked half of all of them and got deathly sick. Now they all giggled. And then they said, well, what about beer? And I said, well, I hate to tell you this, too. I hate the smell of beer because it smells like my parents, okay? But I see you all drink it, and there must be some appeal to it. And so again, at Barley's, I stole a carton of beer. I drank just a sip or two. The odor was god-awful, but I had all the evidence again, so I drank a little of each one and just emptied it out, threw the cans away, and they giggled again. So then I said to them, you want to know what else I stole? And they said, what? I stole a dozen condoms. And I have 12 left.
That's really funny. And they didn't know what to, yeah.
And they said, who was she? And I said, it wasn't a girl. They said, what was it? I said, I hated our principal at Adam Beck. So I knew he was out during recess all the time. So I went to the top of the school, filled it with water, and waited until it dropped by. And I dropped it on her. So, oh, Jesus God, I was so incorrigible, Jeff. It's awful.
That's really a classic. That's a classic.
Well
anyway. John, hold on. As far as the cigarettes go, what you did... You really used aversion therapy on yourself at a very young age, and that probably protected you for life.
Yeah, well, you know what also protected me? I didn't want to be my mother or my father.
No. So, same. We had similar tragic, whatever. We had similar backgrounds. And I had the same thing. I watched alcohol destroy people. I watched them smoke constantly, and I had to live in a house like that. Same. I got it. And well, I felt the same way. I wanted nothing to do with alcohol or smokes. And to this day, nope, I don't drink and I don't smoke. Never have.
And that little story happens to be in my book, which you encouraged me to read. And I have two or three pages of here of something I want to read to you. Because I got a lot of really positive response about the Gong Show last time. This is only 3 pages long. Do you mind if I read it to you?
Please, go to it. Yeah, we'll get there. Okay. Go ahead.
Okay.
We have about 10 minutes, John. About 10 minutes.
I think I can do it in 10 minutes. If not, I'll get to the ending quickly if I can. It was the mid-50s. I was around 20 and had avoided being caught for a few years. I'm in the United States illegally again. Loving it more and more in America, I was consumed with how to become legal. The only possible option was to marry someone. Being a recluse, my only entertainment being television, made meeting girls impossible. There had to be another way, and there was, right in front of me on television, the $64,000 question. Some guy won $64,000 for cooking knowledge. Are you kidding? Dr. Joy's brother is a psychologist, gained fame and fortune, first prize for knowing boxers. And they had to be experts on only one subject. The same was true for the other show I became addicted to, 21, hosted by Jack Barry and created by Dan Enright, a man I would share an office with decades later. The host, this show, was hosted by Hal March. More than that, though, they could win 13 times the money. A guy named Oberholzer won $1 million in those days. $1 million big money at Pentagon. If Oberholzer, with a name that didn't sound American, had been illegal, with that fortune and fame, he would have been given a passport. That would be my passport, the $64,000 question. All I had to do was figure out a subject and learn it. My first discarded choice was Edgar Rice Burroughs and his Tarzan books. I didn't think that was unique or intellectual enough. Then Mark Twain, America's greatest writer, author of Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, and published after his death, Letters to the Earth. Perfect. Beginning my search, I discarded someone I had already flunked that category. Somebody had it already. So I elevated my choice to a greater writer in history, William Shakespeare. I saw Laurence Olivier's Hamlet when I was 15. Of course, I didn't understand all the language, but I loved the theatricality of it. I did not fully appreciate it until I read it, To Be or Not to Be. My God, how brilliant, how moving. A prince talking about suicide in six short words, indeed. Wow, brevity is the soul of wit. At the library, Shakespeare soon took the place of Burroughs. I loved the theater, showbiz. This was a subject I could master. I bought two large loose leaf binders. I joined the public library 5 blocks down on Wilcox. Thankfully, no ID was required. Lies sufficed. There were shelves and shelves of Shakespeare. Two loose leaf binders were not enough. I bought two more and wrote small. Day and night for 2 months, I began my cataloging, reading, and making notes during my lunch breaks, going nowhere, only just watching that show. 37 plays and 154 sonnets. The plays were broken down into categories, comedies, tragedies, and histories, then into one-line scene descriptions and characters. Hundreds of pages cluttered my kitchen table. Before I could put them down in a binder, I'd test myself by picking up one at a random. That endeavor was the only well-organized thing I ever did in my life. Huh. It wasn't a chore. That's more funny. Than that, though, I was seeing myself on television, showing off my applause, getting knowledge. I was growing more and more confident. I went to one of those arcades with a photo booth, had my picture taken for a quarter, and wrote a letter to the producers asking to be a contestant. To ensure they'd pick me, I spent a carbon copy letter to Charles Revson, the president of their main sponsor, Revlon in New York, and another to the president of Geritol, just in case I didn't qualify for the $64,000 question, I'd end up on 21. Walking to work or the library to the market, I was quoting scenes from Romeo and Juliet, tirades from Macbeth, Mark Antony's funeral speech, and my favorite, Richard III's opening monologue. Now is the winter of our discontent made glorious summer by the son of York. I talked to no one, only myself. I was thinking in old English. Every day after mailing my letters, I rushed to the mailbox awaiting my invite. I hated Saturdays and Sundays. They just started of Monday. I became more excited about my appearance and possible fame and passport because of the momentous national media attention being paid to the handsome, young, potential big winner, Charles Van Doren. He was becoming bigger in America than Marlon Brando. He was becoming a cultural superstar. His name and face were everywhere. He had a Jimmy Stewart appeal about him, a round, affable face topped by curly dark hair, the son of a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, the most admired intellectual in the country since Einstein. I wanted him to win because the one thing that could top the wealthy son of a famous father winning $64,000 he didn't need was a poor kid with no parents, me. The whole country was waiting to watch and cheer this big winner. Instead, the nation got to watch the biggest losers in television history, game shows. My breakfast was interrupted by the news. The number one game show, the $64,000 question, was rigged. Charles Van Doren was a fraud. He had been given the answers. Sponsors pulled out immediately. My scrambled eggs came up immediately. The show was canceled immediately. The two other networks followed suit by canceling every quiz show. It was the domino effect of game show destruction. So much outrage from pulpit to press flooded Congress. Hearings were immediately set up to delve into what became known as the quiz show scandals. Years later, there wasn't that much outrage or curiosity from Congress about the murder of President Kennedy. No such moral outrage exists in America today. No shows would be canceled. No one fired. They'd be reassigned to a different show. And Charles Van Doren would be given his own reality show to compete with the Kardashians.
I had literally
puked my dreams and my guts out. With an empty stomach and empty head, I had to face the fact that movie-induced daydreams were not for people like me. Magic does not happen, but luck does. And it soon happened to me when I got a job at Deluxe Film Labs and as an IBM keyboard operator. But first, this Shakespearean aside. I thought, Jeff, the quiz show incident was entirely out of my mind and forgotten like the four lost binders and a thousand other slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. Unfortunately, it wasn't. In 1994, Robert Redford directed a movie about the scandal called Quiz Show. After 10 years as a film critic, I had to quit to pursue my own shows. After doing so, I seldom went to the movies. But I did have this curious urge to see this one. One afternoon, by myself, with popcorn and Coke in hand, I took an aisle seat in the very back corner at the Regal Theater. The theater was relatively full for a weekday screening. Ralph Fiennes played Charles Van Doren. Ralph is a very convincing actor, but I did not like him in this, maybe because he became Charles Van Doren. When he got inside that glass cage, Jeff, to answer the questions he'd been given, I said out loud, "You asshole!" It was the only big laugh in the film. People turned to me chuckling. "Sorry," I whispered. I got up, leaving my popcorn and my Coke.
You left it. That you walked out. That's hilarious. Now, I want to say, I was a little kid, but I remember this country was rocked from coast to coast and shocked by this fraud, this Van Doren. I tell you the truth. It was absolutely incredible
what happened. Afterwards, you and I mentioned this guy, this newscaster at NBC. Was it Brian something or other? He lied about something.
Brian Williams.
Yeah, okay, so he lied, a major lie, as a major newscaster in NBC, and instead of being fired, he was transferred over to MSNBC, where he got another show.
I know. There's no accountability anymore.
There's no outrage in America anymore about any skullduggery.
No, just drag queen book reading for kids, which is perfectly fine, and clapping and applauding moms at gay pride parades with their little children. What have we become? It's incredible. What a story. The Great Quiz Show Caper.
It sounds like a television show. That's incredible. I sued them and won, by the way.
Well done. Very
good. That's what put my son through Stanford.
Well, that's a good use. Better use couldn't be found. Well, John, thank you. Yes.
Oh, you're very welcome, Jeff.
That was a great flashback to a moment in contemporary American history that few would have remembered without that. The great Charles Van Doren outrage. It was big.
That's like
thank you,
faking,
Johnny.
That's like faking the moon landing. Okay.
But on that note, hold on. Did you ever see the interview with Stanley Kubrick that he did and demanded wouldn't be shown until 15 years later after his death?
Yes.
In which he admitted everything. Yeah, you know that because we talked and there was that production about it. It was overly done, but that was Kubrick and that was the truth.
Well, the only thing that bothered me about that, if that guy's going to wait 8 months to interview Stanley Kubrick, he shouldn't interview him in a dark room.
I know. I got it. Okay. You take care. Have a wonderful weekend. Give Sarita a hug, and we'll talk soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.